I'm with Rory Medcalf and Meriden Varel. We're reviewing the year in China. And Rory, I'm going to start with you, particularly on the year in China as, I guess, a foreign policy actor broadly, but more specifically about its maritime assertiveness. If you had to graph the year in China's assertiveness, what would it look like? What are the peaks and troughs?
Well, I think from a perspective of regional order and stability, things certainly got worse for much of the year. The stability index went up, if you like. The instability index went up, if you like. But then things began to dial back down again over the past few months. I think the high point of tension really, I think, came mid-year with China's deployment of an oil rig to contested waters off the coast of Vietnam, leading to really prolonged maritime confrontation and risk. And around that, some pretty fiery rhetoric, the Shangri-La dialogue in Singapore mid-year in particular, where there was confrontational rhetoric between China, Japan and the United States. And then I think in the past few months, things have actually wound back a bit. I think we even are ending the year on a slightly better note, a slightly more secure note than we began, because I get the impression that there's now a heightened awareness in China that it can't take infinite risk with its forces in confronting other countries. And I think the leadership, and even to some extent the PLA, is beginning to become conscious of that. So a small hint of good news as we go into 2015.
Okay, and I think just to follow up, the major signal about that dialing back of assertiveness came in a big speech that Xi Jinping gave last month in Beijing?
Yeah, I think we had a couple of positive signals. Firstly, the conclusion of the Maritime Confidence Building Measures Agreement with the United States when President Obama visited China. And then secondly, soon after that, I think quite an important speech by Xi Jinping that probably hasn't had enough international attention, where he emphasised that although China's rise is, I guess, in some ways, if not inevitable, that the trends are all in China's favour, at the same time, China cannot and should not take risk along the way. And he sent what I think was a message to others within the system, I think including the PLA, that confidence building and risk reduction has to be part of China's package of engaging with its neighbours.
Now, Meriden, I think your perspective on all this is that there's a risk among Western analysts that we don't have a full understanding of China's motives in all this.
Right. I think that, I mean, the way in which, especially in Australia, the discussions about China in the South China Sea, but in China's foreign policy in general, they're very much grounded on these security concerns. And I think that we run the risk then of analysing things according to these material projections, where I believe that they're just symptomatic of a much more coherent and consistent core within China, and that's actually what we have to be looking at and understanding. And I think that the sort of the changes and the shifts and the stability and the instability that we've seen over the last year does not represent any particular central change. And I mean that this year doesn't represent a central change. I think there has been a big shift since Xi Jinping came into power and took over from Hu Jintao about what's happening. But I think that needs to be looked at from that domestic political point of view. And that looking at the South China Sea and this foreign policy behaviour has to go back to that domestic perspective to be truly understood.
A domestic perspective, but also a party-centred perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, when you talk about the domestic perspective, it always goes back to the party. And Xi Jinping is a particularly devout party member. So his discussions, his behaviour, his way of seeing what China's interests are absolutely predicated on the continuing legitimacy of the party in China.
So let's turn then to Xi Jinping's visit to Australia, another big event in China-Australia relations this year. Meriden, just a broad question, I guess. What did you make of the speech to Parliament and the visit more generally?
I think it was very was received very positively, and it was a very skillful piece of diplomacy. China has been criticised a lot in the past, I think, for using diplomatic language that's reminiscent of the language that it uses internally, the sort of communist phraseology that doesn't necessarily make much sense to an outsider, and rather actually puts outsiders a little bit offside. But this time, you know, Xi Jinping's language was extremely sophisticated and understandable from an international perspective. So I think it's been well received. But again, I don't think that that represents any particular change in approach. It represents a more sophisticated way of presenting.
So, Rory, a sophisticated piece of diplomacy, and that can't be seen in isolation, can it? It's sophisticated particularly in relation to the other big speech that happened just a few days earlier, which was Barack Obama's speech in Brisbane.
Well, we had at least three, or if you count, of course, Merkel's speech, four really important speeches happened in Australia in 1 week. And I think Obama's speech was frankly, in some ways, a little tone deaf in the way it engaged with Australian sensibilities, with Australia's interests, with Australia's desire to have the pivot reaffirmed, the alliance put front and centre of US relations in the region. And of course he detoured somewhat into climate change into ways that I think were a bit embarrassing to the Australian government. The other speeches, I think the Indian Prime Minister's speech, Modi's speech, was important, and we can maybe look at that another time. But Xi Jinping's speech, I think, was very well pitched. It was a message of reassurance that surprised some of us. I mean, those of us who had seen the kind of, or had been aware of the kind of chastisement that China had been trying to offer Australia following areas or following incidents of Australian defiance of China's wishes over the air defence identification zone, over Australia not jumping in early to the Asian Development Bank or the Asian Investment Bank that China's trying to develop. Instead, he came with fairly conciliatory language and really a message of strategic reassurance that we shouldn't be afraid of the big guy. Now, of course, we should take this with an enormous grain of salt. Of course, there's going to be continued doubt, uncertainty, even mistrust in the relationship, but at least he's got the messaging right, and that's a net positive at this stage.
So that leads me to another question then, Rory, about what I think we can now safely call superpower relations. What has this year meant for the US-China relationship?
Well, you know, I won't buy into whether we call them both superpowers or not, but I do think that the US-China relationship ends on a reasonably stable note for the time being. Of course, in many ways, the Chinese leadership is simply trying to play a waiting game to work out how to handle the next US administration. And I think that China increasingly is recognising that some of the long-term trends, if it can manage internal problems, if it can manage economic problems, but some of the long-term strategic trends are reasonably in its interest. Its power is growing. The United States is dealing with problems in Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia, all at the same time, plus a tendency in some areas towards isolationism at home. So China feels that it's in a reasonably solid position for the moment. It's decided, I think, not to take as much risk as it's been taking in the past few years, and it will now make a renewed attempt to build some understandings with the United States on a range of strategic issues. The risk here, of course, is the way third countries perceive this, the way third countries respond. If Japan, India and others now begin to sense yet another attempt at a G2, then of course we're going to be in for other kinds of instability and a need for the United States to offer reassurance. But I do think that the kinds of predictions of a year or two ago that the region is on the brink of conflict, the brink of war over the East China Sea or over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, I think that that has proven to be wrong. I think we've come through a rough patch and we just have to get ready for the next one.
So, Merritt and Rory just mentioned the East China Sea. I know you wanted to quickly just review. I mean, it was a very tempestuous year in the South China Sea, but what about in the East China Sea dispute?
Yeah, so the East China Sea must be very clearly separated from the South China Sea. I think a lot of analysts conflate the two and conflate the issues and conflate China's behaviour, presuming that China is interested equally in sort of unilaterally projecting its maritime power in the same way. But the East China Sea and the Diaoyu Senkaku Islands is an entirely different situation. So those islands are, as people probably already know, were always they were always on the back burner as an issue between China and Japan. But in, from China's point of view, those that issue heated up from Japan's behaviour, Japanese behaviour, and China was responding to that shift in the status quo, which they believe Japan began. So, but the China, I believe, isn't looking at trying to own the, those islands and completely control them, in so much as they're concerned about the issue of face to some extent. And I think that helps us understand a little bit more about what China's doing it and why it's doing it and how this can be resolved. If we think that China wants to take and own those islands and that's what its primary objective is, then our policy responses to that are go in a certain direction. If we understand it as that Japan's changed the status quo, Japan's got to step up on China, and China needs to re-equalise the situation to return to the previous equilibrium, and that will mean that it can go back to that old position of putting it on the back burner and letting it be a dormant issue. So the meeting with Abe and Xi Jinping in Beijing in November was the first step to Japan acknowledging that it is a dispute, which is what China is particularly concerned that Japan won't do, and then being able to say, all right, well, now that we've leveled our positions, you've lost face and we've lost face and we're now equal again, I think that will be the way that that can be resolved. I don't think it's about China wanting to actually outright own those islands.
Rory, this was also a year in which China made some relatively prominent military deployments into the Indian Ocean. Is that significant?
Well, I think this is a signal of what to expect in the years ahead, and I think, in fact, we're beginning to see the potential for frictions and problems in the Indian Ocean in the years ahead between China and India. So, really, an Indo-Pacific theatre becoming much more apparent. This year, we saw a Chinese surface action group move into the Indian Ocean for combat simulation exercises not far from Australia's Indian Ocean territories. This, I think, slightly unnerved the Indians. I think it raised a few eyebrows in Canberra too. We also saw evidence of Chinese submarine activities, including a very high-profile visit to Colombo at the very same time that Xi Jinping was visiting India. So a real contradiction in the signals there. Economic diplomacy on the one hand, but a bit of unfortunate strategic signalling on the other, which I think has increased India's mistrust of China. So I think this will be the issue to watch in the year ahead. And this goes back to the state, for example, of US-China relations or other great power relations in the region. It's not good enough to have just the US-China relationship right. That would be, I think, unduly privileging one relationship and unduly privileging the Chinese point of view. China's got to have better relations with India, Japan, other powerful countries in the region if we're going to have a stable era ahead.
Hey, Meriden, Rory talked earlier about the US-China relationship, but I think that, again, there might be a very particular Chinese perspective on that relationship that we're missing.
Right, thanks. So, Rory mentioned that things are looking a little bit friendlier and a little bit warmer between the US and China right now, and I think that's a good point. From the Chinese narrative, the US is always, has been, at least for the last 100 years or so, painted as an enemy. Of course, that's shifted up and down over time, but at the moment it's particularly strong. And the narrative is this historical 100 years of humiliation that started in the 1840s with the Opium Wars, and that China has been encircled and persecuted by Western powers. And the US is pretty much associated synonymous with that. So the US is always the very convenient political other against which China measures itself and which China can identify itself as Chinese and not American. But what China is looking for is not global hegemony. It doesn't want to displace America at all as a global leader. It doesn't want the responsibilities or the rights that come along with that. It's far more interested in resuming its, how it sees resuming its former glory before that 100 years of humiliation as a regionally important player. again, that doesn't look like a hegemon in the sense that we might presume that that's what China's trying to achieve. It's about having a dignity, a respect, and being considered by the others in the region before they make their decisions. So China doesn't necessarily want the US out of the region, out of the Asia-Pacific region, but it doesn't want the US to be making all the decisions and making all the institutions, and that China has to behave according to those rules and those norms that the US has basically set up. So as long as there can be some space, perhaps, for China to exercise some dignity and influence in the region, I think the opportunity for US-China relations is to continue being positive is good. We also see, I think, an interesting trend that when China is treated with dignity and respect, when it is hosting these big events, for example, it tends to behave in a positive way. It tends to be generous. It tends to be more magnanimous than if it's squeezed in or invited as an afterthought or left out altogether. So I think the region, China's goals in the region and the Sino-US relationship need to be considered together, and they need to be considered in light of this history and this narrative of historical persecution and the inevitability of Chinese rise, which is something that's central to Chinese worldviews as well.
Meredith and Rory, thanks for your time.
Thank you.